This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
There's a subsector of anthropology that's called ethnography, which specifically studies cultural phenomena. And this is all cultural phenomena really includes, okay, what are the values? What are the beliefs? What are the practices that basically influence why a community chooses what they choose and why they identify themselves in that way?
Welcome to Tangible Remnants, the podcast that makes adaptive reuse exciting, accessible, and sustainable for every building owner. I'm Nikita Reed, an architect and a champion of reusing existing buildings. I'm excited that you're here, so let's get into it. Welcome back. This week, I'm joined by the inspiring Nina Jean-Louis, and we discuss the intricacies of adaptive reuse projects, the role of structural engineers, and the importance of community engagement. Nina shares her journey from working in a structural engineering company to pursuing her PhD in preservation engineering, and also highlights some of the challenges and motivations behind her decision to pursue her doctorate. I love the way that she elaborates and emphasizes the need for interdisciplinary collaboration and the evolving nature of engineering practices in relation to community needs. She'll also delve in a little bit to her research on quantifying resilience in cultural landscapes, and she'll emphasize the importance of community engagement in interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary methods. Nina also gets into her experiences and insights on the emotional aspects of community work and encourages engineers and architects to embrace this approach. And so before I tell you a little bit more about Nina's background, be sure to check the show notes for resources and to sign up for our newsletter to get tips right to your inbox. One of the resources featured in this episode's show notes includes a news story about Florida's Saltwater Underground Railroad, as well as resources from the Coastal Heritage at Risk Task Force, also known as CHART, that helps to document site and stories in Florida's history. All right, so to give you a little bit of Nina's background, she is a structural engineer passionate about bridging engineering, cultural heritage, and climate science to equip communities with the tools to safeguard their heritage and associated landscapes. During her 10-year career in the engineering and cultural resource industries, Nina has supported various communities, private sector partners, nonprofits, and municipal agencies in solving some of the most challenging preservation and engineering issues, ranging from retrofit repair guidance, resiliency and cultural resource education, community engagement and relationship building with industry professionals, to academia and community stakeholders. She is finalizing her doctoral degree at the University of Miami, which focuses on developing community-driven climate-resilient solutions for protecting cultural landscapes. At the time of this recording, she was finalizing her doctoral degree at the University of Miami, and her work is focusing on developing community-driven climate-resilient solutions for protecting cultural landscapes. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation between me and Nina Jean-Louis. So typically, when doing adaptive reuse projects, the first thing that people or clients often want to know is, well, what can we do with the building? And a lot of times, what I rely on is, well, hang on, let me talk to my structural engineer, and let me make sure that we can get a structural evaluation to get a sense of what's happening with the building. So I know that you have a structural engineering background and all of that. And so I also realize, though, that oftentimes, structural engineers are not typically in that kind of client-facing community engagement piece of it. So I would love to hear from you a little bit about what you've been seeing from your experience in doing some adaptive reuse work.
Absolutely. I mean, you're correct in that regard. I mean, it depends, right? It depends on the size of the firm, and it depends on the client you're working with, right? So, but if you look at our industry timeline of projects, there's always schematic design, design development, then your CDs, your construction documents. And typically, as engineers, we're barely a part of the schematic design. And it's where schematic design that you get to really, the architect really hones in on the actual design and working with the client, adjusting the design, changing things about the design. But as little engineers, we're kind of at the latter end of that process, right? Where we'll come in maybe design development, but we're definitely a part of the CD's construction documents because we are the ones that are making that design come to life, which is an incredible role. I mean, I don't want to minimize that at all. It's an incredible role because we're going in there, we're saying, okay, how can we make this adaptive reuse work? Because we're not, in a lot of cases with adaptive reuse, you're changing occupancy. And so when you're changing occupancy, now you're changing the live loads that you may see. And that's what we're concerned about as engineers. It's like, okay, if you're like expanding the heck out of like a multifamily residential area, right? And you're maybe want to add some industrial things, which I don't, this is a real far-fetched example.
But I get you.
Yeah, but I'm trying to like show the dichotomy because like when you switch to say industrial uses, you're now thinking about a different live load capacity and debt load machinery and things like that.
Right. And live load, just to pause there for a second. So get into live load versus dead load, just for those who are listening in terms of like, all right, what does that mean?
I got you. So dead load, you can think of something that's kind of immovable, right? So if you're walking inside of your house, the best way I like to use an example of your house, right? You walk into your house, it's your furniture. It's, say, your dining room table, your bookshelves, your books themselves. These are kind of the inanimate, solid objects that are kind of going to be there for good, right? Live load is me. I'm the occupant. I'm going in and out of this home, but this home is used primarily as my residence. Now, that live load changes, and these are all prescribed in ASCE, which is a design manual. I see, I think it's now up to 7, it's 21, is it now?
It's somewhere up there. It gets updated regularly.
I've been in PhD land and I haven't done design calc in forever. So I'm like, well, I know I was using 16, so it's 16. But yes, right. Prescribed. So these classifications, even debt loads and live loads are prescribed in these codes such as ASCE, even your local municipal or county building codes, state building codes, IBC, International Building Council. So these are prescribed, right?
Right.
But adaptive reuse, when adaptive reuse starts to come into play, you're changing the use of the space, which means you're changing the live load. So say I did live in a historic house that was residential, but now I want to make it a house museum because it did belong to some historical figure and I wanted to maintain the historical character. You're changing the use now. And so when you're changing the use to say historical house museum, now you're getting into territory where it's not just me going into the house. It's going to be a flux of people going in and out of the home because it's now a house museum. It's not just little me going in and out of the house. It's a whole bunch of people. So that live load changes.
Right. Yeah. And sorry to interrupt, but that's exactly why we also, as architects, make sure that we talk to our structural engineers when we're doing these projects, because that change from, okay, it's just going to be, you know, a small family that's living here, to actually, no, there's going to be maybe 100 or 200 people on this floor at one time. We look to y'all to confirm or let us know, actually, yes, this floor can support that, or no, this floor can't support that. We need to add more columns. We need to improve the structural capacity. So just wanting to make sure to level set for that for listeners who are like, oh, what are you talking about?
You're like, well, why are we talking about this? Yeah, right. That's true, because that's our role, right? When we have adaptive reuse projects, the biggest question is, okay, what's the use change? Because a use change is going to dictate exactly what new loads that we're seeing. And based on the materials that we're looking at, whether it be wood, masonry, steel, concrete, we're going to have to reanalyze a little bit. And then if it's a historic property that we're adaptively reusing, which is why we're here today, we're talking about heritage and adaptive reuse, is that you also have to see, okay, well, given the current load, are we seeing issues? And if we're going to change this load, maybe dramatically increase the live load, now will these members, say your walls, your columns, and it also depends on where this is located too. So if you are doing an adaptive reuse in Florida, you have hurricane winds to worry about that are prescribed a lot higher than any other states. It's the same when you go to California, right? You're not going to design for earthquake in Florida, but you will in California. So these will impact your design in the future. But like I said, we're on the latter end. So all those kind of decisions of use, what the client may want to use, engineers, we're not really a part of that conversation. We're at the tail end where we're like, okay, I got the use now. Now let's go run and let's do this existing condition assessment and let's see with the existing members that we're seeing and in their current condition, let's see if it can take the new load.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And like, I think one of the things that is interesting to me, like when we're doing kind of our prep call talking through this, I was like, I hadn't thought about the fact that typically we don't have the structural engineers. In most cases, we don't have them like on the front end with the client, but there are sometimes I've had some projects where we've actually brought structural engineers with us to the interview because it was like a tricky project where they wanted to open up a bunch of walls and things were going to get a little unstable. So we had to bring the structural engineer in to explain exactly what was going to happen structurally. But it also speaks to kind of just the interdisciplinariness of the teams and all of that, and why it's so important to make sure that you have quality folks on your team who know what they're doing and who know when to reach out. Because yes, I'm an architect. Yes, I understand how buildings work, but I also know when I need to talk to my structural engineer to confirm, because I'm not running the formulas and calculations or the moment frames. Like, I'm not paying attention to all of that most of the time.
You're like, no, thank you. I mean, I say no, thank you too.
Exactly. Where is my engineer?
I mean, yeah. And I think it's just the way how our industry is set up. And this is just my own personal opinion based off of my own lived experience in this industry. Because like I said, before my PhD, I was in the industry for around 8-9 years. And so what I saw, it was a culture in the industry. It's this kind of a cultural norm in the construction, architectural, engineering industry where it's really the architects or the owner's rep that are really the closest to the client themselves. Where this changes, though, is when you say have a non-for-profit client where it kind of requires a little bit more hands on deck, because if it's a non-for-profit client that is a representative of the community, yes, that's going to have a little bit of a longer timeline than your traditional engineering projects would say a developer or just, you know, a housing I don't know, like your private sector client.
Right, exactly. And a lot of times also our clients, even not-for-profits or even people who are just doing their first adaptive reuse project, they don't know what they don't know. And so a lot of times being able to get in there to help them through the process, because sometimes people are like, oh, well, we signed the contract, we start construction next week, right? And it's like, oh no, there's so many steps between signing the contract and starting construction.
People know what they know and they don't know what they don't know.
Right. And so it's like the same way that like I don't expect to be able to run a nonprofit great because I've never run a nonprofit before. Being able to like talk to clients and help them understand that, hey, you've never done an adaptive reuse before, so I don't expect you to know everything. That's why you're hiring the professionals to do that. So let us be professionals and lead you through the process. And so you were in the industry for a while, but now you went back to get your PhD. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about what prompted that and also tell the audience more about what you're studying and all of that.
Absolutely. What prompted it? COVID. It was the pandemic, but it was kind of an alignment. You know, I was working for a small engineering firm in Old Town Alexandria. I absolutely loved working for them. They were an incredible team, incredible people. And I loved what I did, but I still often felt that design and analysis wasn't fully my calling and fully my purpose. It was not that I was trying to compare myself with others in the fields, but I just didn't have the same passion in doing design calcs as some of my other colleagues, because I always felt there was something missing. What kind of gave me that something missing was when I was a part of the Disaster Response Initiative and the Inclusion Advocacy Committee of Association of Preservation Technology, where we had a pilot community project in Little Haiti around 2018, it started. And through that, I gained relationships with UM colleagues, UM being the University of Miami. And as I was kind of circling back and thinking, okay, I relocated back to South Florida after the pandemic to be closer to my family, I was also saying that my current role remote wasn't potentially really working, because something I will say for everyone, like, when you're working in preservation, I would love to learn how people have done it successfully remotely, but I need to be interacting with the building itself. I need to be on site. Sure, I can go through pictures. I mean, when you have the certain expertise and when you have certain years of experience basing off of pictures, you can do, but that's a big liability, right? If you're practicing with your licensure, solely basing the conditions off of pictures is liability. But I've always been someone that's needed to interact. And I saw the challenge of actually doing the role that I was having in Washington, D.C. metro area remotely in Florida. The only way that I could see it working is if I were to expand their services into the Florida area. And I was like, okay, we're at a fork in the road. And I kind of got reflective and was like, okay, you've enjoyed this work with APT. Why? Why did you enjoy this work? And for me, it was, I wanted just a better understanding of the community and what they were doing to protect their sites, and learning from the community and learning from that traditional knowledge, and have that be scientific knowledge as well. It's often what I call a gray area of knowledge that unfortunately doesn't get supremely recognized by the industry, even parts of academia. I mean, that's changing now, but this passion to just bridge engineering, this preservation engineering, the knowledge, the skill set that I have with cultural heritage and climate science to better help communities safeguard their heritage and their heritage landscapes, that was really driving me. And so when I was in around 2019, 2020, kind of circling back to some of the participants in the Little Haiti project to get their lessons learned, who's now my advisor, Dr. Andaroglu, he was hearing me talk about how passionate I am about this. And he's like, did you ever consider doing a PhD? I'm like, oh, I'm old. I'm 30. At the time, I was 30, right? Age myself here. But I was like 30 going on to like 31. And I was like, I'm too old to do this. And he's like, no, Nina, you're not. Anybody can do a PhD. And I was like, oh, but that means I would have to leave the industry, basically take a really big hit to my pay cut. I mean, sure, I consulted on the side still thereafter, but there's a certain point in your PhD that you can't take anything else on and you just have to focus. But he's like, yeah, and we're looking for in the Department of Civil and Architectural Engineering community-driven methodologies to do this work more effectively. And I said, all right, I'm your person. And so that's how the PhD journey started. It kind of came out of left field, but I was like, I'll take it.
Yeah.
I will say it's not for the faint of heart. Yeah. No. Mm-hmm.
100%. And like, I love that it was something that you were open to, because I was curious, like, was it something that you always knew you wanted to get a PhD in this particular field of study? But hearing that it's something that evolved makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But it's also one of those things where, like, not going to lie, I would not have thought of like a PhD in civil engineering, or like, not on my radar, but that's amazing. And I'm glad that you're going through it.
Yeah.
How has the process been and where are you in that work?
Yeah, so I'm actually in my final year. I'm in post-candidacy, which means I've been through my qualifying exams. I've been through my proposal defense. So I'm in the final, if I would say this is a marathon, you know, a marathon's like 26 miles. Girl, I don't run. But if I were to compare it to that, I am in, say, mile 20 right now.
Amazing.
Right? So,
well, congratulations for making it that far. You got this. It's like downhill from here, right?
Yeah, kind of. You know, it's just the thesis has to get fully written. That's been a little slow. And then you have a whole bunch of data analysis interpretation from the field work, right? So,
okay.
And I'll get into more into that. But like I said, it's not for the faint of heart. You really, when I tell people that are considering their doctorates, don't just do it because you have no other option, because that's not going to be a good enough purpose for you to stick through it, because you're going to run through funding challenges. You're going to run through, especially doing community work, you're going to run through trying to even get an interdisciplinary team all on the same page, then being on the same page with the community. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort. And so you have to have a very deep purpose and of just your why to constantly go back to when you feel like you're going to quit. There's many times I wanted to quit because it was like, I don't know where my funding is coming from, or, oh man, this is trying to get everyone on the same page. Am I doing it right? Like, you start asking yourself, like, is this going to be really feasible? Because my work is in an engineering department, but I'm doing very community-focused work, and that's something the department hasn't seen. So it takes patience on both of our ends to say, hey, yeah, I get it's uncomfortable that we're doing something completely new, but that's what PhD research is all about, is doing something new and novel, and especially because engineers are not really known to do community work. So this is kind of the first of its kind that the department has seen.
And what I love about what you just said and the through line that I was seeing was that I feel like your work in preservation before you went back to it totally prepared you for that, with the idea of like the uncertainty. It's giving like unforeseen conditions, mm-hmm. having to figure things out on the fly, because things that you discovered during construction aren't as you thought they would be during design. Why are we doing this? Are we going to get the approval? Where is the funding coming from? Like, all of that. So I think that's a really interesting through line that you were ready for it.
Absolutely. I love that you saw that, because I didn't, but okay. Yes. No, it's true. And now that I reflect on what you just said, I mean, yes, when I was in active construction sites and active restoration projects, you know, it's depending on where the money is coming from, depending on the clients, the subcontractors. We've had subcontractors ditch the job site. We've had subcontractors do terrible jobs. Mm-hmm. Like, so mm-hmm. you have to kind of weather the storm and also collaborate and facilitate as best as possible.
Absolutely. So see, you're prepared. You got this. This is why I am not concerned about you finishing, but I understand that you're in the thick of it. But just to mm-hmm. let you know, we're rooting for you. You got this.
Yay.
And so I would love for you to talk a little bit and share what you can about some of the work that you're doing in the program. I think particularly around American Beach on Amelia Island, and mm-hmm. tell that story a little bit and how that work's progressing.
Yes. So my overarching research is, the main purpose is to ask the question, how can we holistically quantify resilience for cultural landscapes. What does that look like? And so, yes, because I'm an engineering department, there is a desire to obviously quantify this. But the quantification side is also something to help supplement feedback, whatever it may be, for policy decision making, even in terms of effective implementation of policies for communities, right? So, and the thing is about cultural landscapes, they're a lot more challenging than your typical heritage site. Cultural landscapes are this symbiotic relationship between human society and their natural environment. And in that interaction, there arises the cultural natural heritage. And that's both tangible and intangible. So it's this kind of ecosystem meeting that, you know, the actual human society and what's being produced out of that, which I understand why it hasn't always been first approach, because it's the scale is a much, much larger than a heritage site. So it's different than what I'm used to, because I am very used to, all right, here's a historic building. I can see everything that's wrong with it. I could see if there's a hurricane, what's going to fail first. Like, I can talk all day about that. But what was really unexplored was this relationship and then the actual value that people have to these sites. It's like, what if we actually looked at climate resilience through relationship, such as relational values, than just tangible? Because it's the why, it's the significance that really dictate how people choose or not to choose to adapt.
Because when we're talking about landscapes, just to give people a sense of the scale of what you're talking about. Because like, yeah, you're talking about the building. I think everyone can kind of understand, okay, this is a building, it's here. But like when you're talking about landscape, sometimes it could be a block, it could be a neighborhood, it could be many, many acres. It could be more than just something that you can visually see all kind of once with your eye. Like sometimes you have to see and look at maps of an area to understand the landscape and all that. So just the scale is much different. So I just wanted to kind of help contextualize that.
And the thing is, you start off with maps. You start out maybe what in policy documents or what is existing, what has originally delineated the boundaries. But what I love about the community-based participatory research aspect of my work, and I'll get into like the methodology in a bit. What I love about that is that you're taking those boundaries, but they're kind of being exploded. Having the community define those boundaries, right? Because this is where it's different, right? So I am bridging in my research to holistically quantify cultural landscape resilience. I am claiming my hypothesis is we need transdisciplinary methods. What is transdisciplinary? It extends interdisciplinary, which it extends beyond just different disciplines working with each other. And I mean, not just hard science to hard science, such as engineering to marine biology. It's hard science with social science. So I am taking systems and reliability engineering and merging it with anthropology, because anthropology is a discipline that is really well versed in studying people, period. Studying people, there's a subsector of anthropology that's called ethnography, which specifically studies cultural phenomena. And this is all cultural phenomena really includes, okay, what are the values? What are the beliefs? What are the practices that basically influence why a community chooses what they choose and why they identify themselves in that way? So I'm taking tools, making a little toolbox out of that, because I'm advocating that we need to start with ethnography as a means to enter community, right? Especially in a more rapid, condensed way, because real ethnographic, I'm not trying to make us all ethnographers out there, because that's a whole field in itself. But if I'm an engineer or if I'm an architect, what tools from this toolbox can I use to do my job more effectively with communities? That's the question that I'm trying to answer and using some of these tools. So I'm using participatory mapping. I'm using semi-formal interviews. I'm using informal interviews. I'm using participant observation. These are all different tools to help me understand the sites that are important to the American Beach community, which American Beach is my case study. Why are they important? And then through some of these interviews and narratives, I get to really kind of pull out more relational values. And so I'm beginning with that. Given that I have to quantify this in the end, I mean, we are wanting to create some sort of composite resilience metric. And so with this metric, it's going to basically merge the qualitative data that we're getting out of these focus groups and these mapping sessions with quantitative. So some of that client science data, those hazards, whether it be sea level rise, hurricane velocity data, merge these two together to come up with a composite metric that says, hey, this is your resilience score for this area. But we're not just stopping there. We're not just stopping at the number, because I told my department, and I truthfully believe, I don't want to stop at a number, because community is going to see that and be like, okay, what does number 5 mean?
Like, right. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. And so I want to try to translate it into a visual scale. So like a red light, so red, green, yellow, and have the, it's better visualized with multiple communities. American Media is going to be our first one, but essentially you'll have multiple communities on the scale. And depending on where they fall is their resilience risk. So if somebody falls in the green, their resilience risk is relatively low. But if they fall in the red, it's high. And then the GIS maps that I'm creating showing the vulnerabilities of some of these relational values and where they're concentrated, that enables Venn to say, okay, now we know where to allocate resources for some of the, to preserve the values, not just the sites, but the values and the stories associated with them. So that's a really big nutshell of what I'm doing.
And the way that you wove together the different, not even just disciplines, but you were saying kind of combining the hard science with the soft science and looking at the engineering with the anthropology and seeing how all of these things play together. I love how you're weaving that together and even taking it a step further to not only do the quantitative and give it a number, but then also translate it to the community so the community understands what they should also be focusing on and help them understand what to prioritize. Because I think that's the piece that sometimes gets missed with some of the studies that we'll do and all that, where it becomes a, here's this architectural or engineering study, and it sits on the shelf because it doesn't get communicated and shared out more widely with the community. And it's that broken down in a way for the community to understand how to engage with this information. So I'm really excited about the work that you're doing. And this sounds like super cool. And I'm glad that you like explained it a little bit more, because I feel like I had a surface level understanding and I was filling in some of the gaps and I was like, maybe it means this and maybe it means that. But no, I now know what it means. And that's amazing.
Yeah. And so why I chose American Beach, I mean, I'm going to be really honest with you. I'm Afro-Caribbean myself. And, you know, my mother is from a region of Costa Rica in the south, from Puerto Limon, which is a very heavily Afro-Caribbean populated area. And my father, even though he was born in the U.S., he's from, his family lineage is from Haiti. And so I've always had this understanding, and being born in America, raised in America, I had trouble seeing my own culture being talked about or my own heritage being spoken about in the grander scheme of American history. So I really wanted to dedicate my work to more of these marginalized sites. And when I say marginalized, I'm primarily saying it's not only, it doesn't have to only be socioeconomic, right? But it's more so like racially as well. And, you know, in terms of the ethnic groups that are there. And it's including also rural communities versus urban communities, right? These are all considered marginalized communities because they're not looked at in the same way as, say, an urban community and an urban community that is predominantly white or predominantly one race, right?
So, right. And the investment's different as well.
Absolutely. I mean, a little tidbit for those who are trying to understand how race kind of plays in this, The Color of Law is a great book for that, especially in understanding how race played a role in the investment of certain areas and communities and why redlining was developed, right? Mm-hmm. So I say all this because I wanted to focus my work in communities of color, especially those of Afro-Caribbean or Afro-American descent. So hence American Beach. And the way that I was introduced was, you know, preservation is a small world, as you know. And so I'm a part of also this task force that's called the Coastal Heritage At-Risk Task Force. We were already doing a lot of work in the area, basically restoring sites that had certain colonialized narratives that now we're working with communities to share a different perspective or the actual narrative of the community, right? Or the site.
Yeah, to fill out the narrative, to tell a fuller history of what is there.
The descendants of some of those individuals. And so we're trying to see, especially where American Beach, our focus in CHART, the Coastal Heritage At-Risk Task Force, is on sites pertaining to the Saltwater Underground Railroad. And so if you think about the Underground Railroad, famous by Harriet Tubman, this was an extension of it with waterways. And so these were waterways that were traveled by the formerly enslaved from the South into Florida because it had more freedoms than, say, certain areas of the South. And those freedoms were also reflected in areas like the Bahamas as well. So it were these waterways that the formerly enslaved used to travel to try to get to more free areas. And so we're trying to see like what sites may fit into that narrative. And so we were also kind of a secondary research objective of my work is seeing how American Beach fits into that narrative. And so that's how I got introduced. And I have been working with them pretty much almost a year now that I think of it.
Nice. I hadn't known about the Saltwater Underground Railroad until you were talking about it during the prep call. So that intersection of it is super fascinating. And just the reminder of the different migratory patterns and the ways that people fought for themselves and did what they could to get free. It definitely feels like the past has a lot of tips for us to look through and get inspiration from for our current situation of today.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So then are there any things that have surprised you as you've been doing more of this research and anything that you're looking forward to?
Well, the one thing that surprised me is exactly how lucky I am to be working with such an incredible group of people. That I have been learning so much from them. And that's, I think that's how it really should be in these exercises, is that often as subject matter experts, we sometimes go into community work with this savior mentality that we know better, we know we're the subject matter experts, let us come in and help you. But it's really an exercise of helping each other. And it's an exercise in not only introducing my own skill set to the community, but it's also learning from them of what is really important to them, because that's something I can't define for the community, right? And so what has been so surprising is just the amount of oral history that I'm receiving and that I'm getting. And it's just, it's incredible. It's incredible. And like I said, a community work can always go one or two ways. You're either pulling teeth to get work or like get interviews. And it's hard. I think too, even as blessed as I've been working with this community, like community work is a lot harder than I thought, actually. Like I was like, okay, I've been through preservation advocacy and outreach. I've been on, you know, certain boards about this, but you learn new things with each community. And it is something that I am learning about myself is that if you are an empath or a highly sensitive person, you will feel things deeply. And so I am working with a community that has lived through segregation. And so sometimes when I hear those stories of their experiences, it hits. And I've had to take a lot of breaks to kind of get up. And after the interview, like clear my stuff on the calendar when I'm in the field to kind of rest and recover. That's why I said like community work, I understand it is not made for everyone. No, it is not. You do have to have a degree of empathy and desire to do the work. Because even when I've taught about empathy, I teach a course on empathy in the Innovation Technology Design Program at UM, how to basically incorporate empathy in your design processes. And not all my students are meant for it. And I tell them that's okay. That's okay. You're going to have to walk through this exercise, but at least you understand why this happens. And so, yeah, like walking, you know, I'm still in the process of interpreting a lot of my data, but yeah, there was a lot of surprising, like one, it's a lot hotter than I thought, no matter how well organized, no matter how many people, the plethora of resources and people I have. That's not the norm either. I tell people my case study, I am very lucky because of the people. It's because of them, of why this has been, I would say, quote unquote, much easier than, say, another community that some of my colleagues have worked on, right? That it included longer time for trust and rapport building and all of that. Yeah, and especially as an empath and HSP, not realizing too emotionally, it's kind of that dividing your subjective and objective self. Like, you have to show up actually more objectively. But as an empath and as an HSP, it's sometimes hard to do that because you feel what the interviewee is going through. But that's kind of where you get your subjective self. They talk about this in ethnography, the objective versus subjective self. And you want to be very careful with a subjective self because you don't want that to influence your notes and how you're writing your field notes. You don't want to influence the interpretation of, you know, your interviewee's answers. And that was by far probably my biggest challenge.
Yeah, that's fair. And like, I know with a lot of community work, it's always you're moving at the speed of trust. Or is it a lot of times, I think a lot of professionals, particularly design professionals, want to come in and be like, oh, I know the answer. It's like, nope, you don't know the answer because you need to talk to the community to see what they want. And you said that so beautifully in terms of you can't determine what the community values. You have to listen. You have to, you know, interact and understand.
It's a slow science. That's a challenge in it too, because our industry and academia, especially on the hard sciences, and even with anthropology today, it embraces social science a little better. But community work is something that engineering is not very used to doing. And so they kind of are still applying the same industry standard to community work and doesn't work that way. So advocating for a slow science that you are on the timeline of their trust, like you said, that takes time. And even getting the focus groups together, even processing, all of that takes time and often more time than you think. I do want to encourage engineers and architects to just consider this work a little bit more at the forefront of our process. I know we're not going to change the industry cultural norm tomorrow, but we can all move the needle, right? And I would have to say, you know, it is okay if you are very hesitant about doing this work and not knowing what to do. I mean, this is why I'm doing the research I'm doing. I'm an engineer that is doing community work, and I want to show other engineers, architects, people, construction and personnel, people in this industry that, yeah, we can do it too. And this is a way of doing it. But I always say it's, you have to prepare time-wise. You have to prepare emotionally, because especially if you're in areas that deal with marginalized heritage, there's going to be some damaging narratives that come about. And you're going to have to understand how to not only objectively view that, but also how to handle sometimes some more emotionality that arises out of community resonance too. So I kind of dive into that too in my dissertation as well.
Thank you so much for listening. Links to amazing resources can be found in the episode's show notes. Special thanks to Sarah Gilberg for allowing me to use snippets of her song Fireflies from her debut album, Other People's Secrets, which, by the way, is available wherever music is sold. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the show. And now that Tangible Remnants is part of the Gable Media Network, you can listen and subscribe to all network partner content at gablemedia.com. That's G-A-B-L. media.com. Until next time, remember that historic preservation is a present conversation with our past about our future. We don't inherit the earth from our parents, but we borrow it from our children. So let's make sure we're telling our inclusive history.
I saw the first fireflies of summer, and right then I thought of you. Oh, I could see us catching them and setting them free. Honey, that's what you do. That's what you do to me.
Hey, designers and curious minds. Ever wondered about the stories hiding within your building's walls? I'm Carrie Seaburn, structural engineer and host of Unstruct, the podcast that decodes and simplifies major concepts of structural design. Behind the math and physics, structural engineering simply predicts building behavior. Join me as we simplify the complex making structural design accessible to everyone.
Nowadays, instead of measuring it via cost, we're saying, well, what about carbon, you know? We've got two levers now that we can, if an architect has an inefficient design, we can hit them with two levers, if you like.
The official casualty figure is 55,000. Everybody I talked to told me that the actual figure is at least three times as much. And I believe that. I mean, seeing what I saw, Turkish codes are good and they have been improving, but compliance was completely lacking.
Fluent in steel, concrete, masonry, and timber design, I'll bring you leading engineers to dissect the tales behind their building structure. Whether you're an architect, contractor, engineer, or just love a good story, this podcast is for you.
Yeah, beam penetrations. That's a fun topic on this project.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Unstruct. From within your walls, hear the story behind how your building stands today.